I invite you to hear these words now that come to us from the Old Testament, from the book of Exodus. Hear now these words. Then God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Now, I was thinking about a new series for the new year, and so I did some praying, I did some research, and I did some thinking, and I came up with all kinds of ideas. And so here are some of my ideas, and, you know, you can let me know which way you want us to go, but, you know, I thought, you know, it's a new year, so we'll do a new year, a new you. How's that? All right, well, if that didn't work, how about a new year, same sins? How about a series on the year of good riddance? No? Well, then, I sort of thought about, we always come up with a bunch of New Year's resolutions at the start of a new year. And I thought, well, okay, let's do a series incorporating some of the more common New Year's resolutions. And I thought, well, okay, we'll do less of me and more of Jesus, the ultimate diet plan. How's that? Or how to use desserts to help with stress, because actually stress spelled backwards is actually desserts. Sound good? No? All right. Well, I thought about all those, and then I thought, you know what? Let's do a series on the Ten Commandments. I mean, how exciting would that be, right? A whole series on the Ten Commandments. And I was sharing that with one of my kids, and they said, really, Dad? You're going to do a series on the Ten Commandments? That just sounds boring. You know, there's all those rules and all those shout nots. I mean, how many are there again? I said, well, you know, since we call them the Ten Commandments, there are ten. I said, but we're not gonna spend 10 weeks on it. We're actually just going to spend 9 weeks, because we're going to double up on one of them, because we only got 9 weeks between now and actually Ash Wednesday, which is the very first of March. And then my kid said, well, what's Ash Wednesday? So, regardless of the less than enthusiastic support and response from one of my children, we are beginning a new series on the Ten Commandments, okay? And I promise I'm gonna do my best not to make it boring. And my hope is that we will come to look at these commandments as more, something more than just rules or shout nots, okay? But instead that we begin to appreciate them and appreciate them as guidelines and as guideposts and maybe as guardrails to help us find the good life and the beautiful life that God intends for us. Because I think they're meant to point us to what the world is supposed to be, what we're supposed to be like, how, you know, we're to treat one another and how we're to relate to God, God's self. So, it's not a bunch of rules. I don't believe that they are. And I believe all the shout nots really point us to a deeper thou shalt. And so, again, over these next 9 weeks, we're gonna focus on these commandments. We're gonna learn them. We're gonna memorize them. We're gonna try to understand really what they mean, and to see how, and to see the thou shalt behind the shalt not. So as we begin to do that, I want to give us a little bit of context, a biblical context behind these commandments. Now, there are how many again? Yeah, there are 10. It's not a trick question. That's why we're calling this series 10. Okay, get it? All right, but what I want us to understand is that the first four of the commandments have everything to do with how we relate to God. All right, so the first four, how we relate to God. And then the following six are how we are to relate to one another. First four, relate to God. The following six, how we are to relate to one another. And there's a reason that they're ordered in this way, because you got to understand that we begin by being in a right relationship with God, because if we're in a right relationship with God, then we can have more fulfilling relationships and better relationships with one another. Now, we find these commandments in Exodus chapter 20 or Deuteronomy chapter 5. So they're in the scriptures twice there. And if you compare the two, there's some slight differences there, but very little, very little. Well, in doing my research, what I have found interesting is that there's some disagreement as to what the first commandment really is, believe it or not. Our Jewish friends, okay, our Jewish brothers and sisters, they look at the first commandment in the words that say, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." That's what they say the first commandment is. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt and out of the house of slavery." Now, Christians, we tend to look at that verse as sort of the preamble, all right, to the Ten Commandments. So, even though our Jewish friends know the first commandment is, "I am the Lord your God," most of us, Christians, identify the first commandment as what comes after that, which reads, "You shall have no other gods before me." So our Jewish friends say, "No other God" is the first commandment. All right. "I am the Lord your God" is the first commandment. And then "You must have no other gods before me" is the first commandment. Now, even there in Christian circles, there's a little bit of disagreement in that. Now, our Catholic and our Lutheran friends, they add what we consider to be the second commandment to the first one. All right, so when they say that the very first, traditionally, they say the first commandment is this: "You shall have no other gods before me." What we all agree is the first one. But then they add, "You shall not make yourself an idol." Now, we consider that to be commandment number two. Most Christians do. Catholics, Lutherans, say, "You must have no other gods and shall not make yourself an idol." So they combine what we say is one and two, they combine them into the first one. And then later on, when it comes to coveting, they split that out, and that's how they arrive at 10. Okay? It's the same for all of us. It's just how we kind of organize it. Our Jewish friends, they organize it a little bit differently. They start with what we call a preamble. Our Catholic and Lutheran friends, they kind of combine the first two and separate, I think, number nine in that. But they're still all the same, okay? So they're all the same. But we, most Christians, again, we begin with, "You shall have no other gods before me." So that's where we're going to start today. "You shall have no other gods before me." Now, again, we look at this commandment, "You shall have no other gods before me." Well, that's not very hard, right? That's an easy one. I don't worship Baal, okay, the Eastern Canaanite god. I don't worship Horus or Sirius or Ra, the gods of the Egyptians. No part of me is tempted to worship Zeus. And so, you know what? I think I got this one. No other gods before me. I don't have any other gods. That is, if you define other gods as other deities or mythical figures, all right? But I'm going to suggest to you that maybe we need to redefine what we mean by gods. And I think you already know this, right? So when I think of what other gods are and how they function in our lives today, I would offer maybe these definitions that those other gods are. Anything that takes the place of God in our lives. That might be one. Or that which claims our highest allegiance. Or we might define God as that to which we are most devoted to in our life. Or perhaps that which has the greatest influence on our thinking and on our behavior. Or that which we truly love more than anything or anyone else. Or that which we value more than anything else. Or that which drives us, or what is most important to us, or drives us the most. So when we think about it in that way, then this commandment takes on a little deeper meaning, doesn't it? All right. I mean, I want God to be first in my life. I want to have no other gods before God, but if I am being honest with myself, I struggle with that. because there are many other things that strive for my soul, for my heart, for my attention. I spend time focusing on, pondering on, think other things that drive me. So have no other gods before me. Yeah, that's the first one, and maybe it's the hardest of all. That's why Jesus said, when he was speaking to first century peasants in Palestine, he said, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be loyal to the one and have contempt for the other. You cannot serve both God and wealth. Well, you could substitute wealth for anything else. You cannot serve both God and vocation. You can't serve just serve God and family, God and hobbies, God and leisure, God and wealth. It doesn't matter. Cannot serve two masters, says Jesus. Now, none of these other things are bad, but we struggle with them, don't we? I mean, let's take money, wealth, for instance. Money is morally neutral. Okay, it can be used for either good or for evil, but that is how we choose to use it. Money in and of itself is just morally neutral. I mean, but when we take something that's meant to be subordinate and we make it primary in our lives, that's when things begin to go sideways. We find things don't work out the way that they're supposed to work in our lives, or the way God would hope that they would work in our lives. Yeah, I think about a pastor, the request of a pastor in 1861. He petitioned the U.S. Treasury Department. He said, you know, is there any way we could put something about God on our coins so that it might help us remember that this is not God, that something else is God, someone else is God? And so eventually, by 1864, they came up with the first coin that had "In God We Trust" printed on it. It was a 2-cent piece, got a picture of it. And what does it say? It says, "In God We Trust." It's the very first coin that appeared on. Now, move ahead almost 100 years. In 1955, Congress mandated that "In God We Trust" should be included, or would be included, on all U.S. currency. So every coin, every piece of paper money has "In God We Trust" on it. But is that really true for us? Do we trust God more than the coin, than the paper money, than the wealth, than the IRA? I hope we do. But if we're honest, the reality is we struggle with it. And many times, probably, we trust more in the currency, the money, the wealth, than we do in God. Now, that's just maybe one false god. I mean, like I said, there's a lot. It could be relationships. It could be, you know, just this what drives you, again, what drives you, what you focus on. It might be this desperation to have someone like you. Or maybe it's what drives you is to have more stuff, to have that vacation home, or whatever it might be. It might be success. It might be popularity. It could simply be health. Again, not bad things. Not bad things. There's nothing wrong with any of them. But until they become the God that we serve and everything revolves around it. And I think about, you know, the people in our lives who are to be most important to us, you know, maybe our spouse, you know, our family, our children. And again, those are wonderful, wonderful things. But does God ask us to put them first over himself? No. God doesn't call us to put our family or our children or our relationships above the relationship we're to have with God. See, there's something that happens when we love God first. See, when we love God first, I believe God opens up our hearts so that we can love others even more fully. Okay? That our capacity to love others grows. When we love God first, our capacity to love others grows. We become less selfish, less me focused. We become more, we're more willing to sacrifice. When we love God first, we're able to love people better than if we love them first and God second. That's what God's saying here in this first commandment. Have no other gods before me, because I am to be at the center. And I know that's not an easy thing. It's not easy for me. It's not easy. I don't think it's easy for anybody. And maybe that's why in the Bible, humanity's very first temptation is when the serpent is whispering to Eve and saying, hey, you know, come and eat from this, eat the fruit of the tree in the center of the garden, the tree of the of knowledge and good and evil. Do you remember that? Find it in Genesis 3. The serpent whispering to Eve, oh, come on, eat of the tree. Eat the fruit of the tree of good and evil, the knowledge of good and evil. Now, here's the thing. The fruit wasn't the temptation, okay? It was the means to the temptation. The temptation was, hey, if you eat of this fruit, you'll be like God. What's the serpent say? It says, for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. That was the temptation, to be like God. And so the first temptation, and maybe the one that's underneath everything, is, you know what? I get to be like God. Now, we call it narcissism or hubris or pride or an unhealthy ego, okay? Ego is important, but it becomes unhealthy when you believe the whole world revolves around you. Right, when it's all about, you know, when it's all about them, and that, what does that do? That just ruins relationships. It really just ruins everything when it's all about you. But when it's about God, and then it's about other people, suddenly you find that life, this is the way life was meant to be. You find that life is good and beautiful. It's why God starts with this one. And by the way, ego, when you begin to put yourself above everything else, then ego becomes, as someone once said, edging God out. I like that acronym, edging God out. If you try to build your foundation on ego, on your desire for things, whether it's popularity or sex or power or money or something or someone else, you miss out on the good and the beautiful life, God says. Yeah, some years ago, I did clinical pastoral education at Carolina Medical Center. We call it CP, but it's clinical pastoral education. And my supervisor and I were having lunch one day, and we were talking and about the hospital and the care that hospital chaplains give and all those kinds of things. And he said, you know, it's interesting that other than those who are coming to give birth, he said, everybody who comes to a hospital is sick in some way, okay? As a patient, okay? As patients. So other than those who are coming to give birth, everyone else who comes as a patient is sick in some way. He said, it's the funny thing about being sick and what it does to you. He said, it helps you think about what really matters in life. Because the sicker you are, the more certain things become clear. The more certain things become clear, and how other things are really not that important. And it's true, you know, Facebook's not, you know, doesn't matter very much when you're sick. The quest for wealth doesn't matter so much when you're sick. Popularity, clothing, sex, power, doesn't matter very much when you're sick. Again, he said, the sicker you get, the more you realize what really matters. And what really matters? He said, well, for most folks, it's the relationships they have with other people. And then for some, it's the relationship they have with God, or the relationship they don't have with God. He says, as you approach death's door, you realize there's really only one hope. Only one hope that is left. So are you going to trust the guy that stands on the other side with his arms wide open and says, you know what, you're mine, I am yours, welcome home? Or are you going to trust something or someone else? See, again, what's the one thing in your life that drives you? What's the most important thing for you? I recall I was sitting with a couple from a church I once served, and the husband had discovered or had been told by his doctor that his kidneys were slowly beginning to fail. Now, he was already on dialysis, all right? So he was already doing that, but the dialysis wasn't doing what it needed to do as good as it used to do. And so his kidneys were slowly beginning to fail. It was terminal. Basically, the doctor said, hey, it's terminal, okay? And so we talked about that, and we talked about how they were handling this diagnosis, and Bill said, you know what, I just stop and think about all the things that I am thankful for, all the things that I am grateful for, you know, the blessings in my life, and I think about all of it, and I just, you know, all of it, it's just a gift, he said, and I'm just grateful for those things and for what God has done in my life. And then his wife spoke up and said, you know, I know that whatever happens, it's going to be okay. You know, we're not afraid of death. Our faith means a lot to us. It's going to be okay. Now, that didn't mean that they didn't have bouts of fear from time to time, because they did, all right? I mean, there's still going to be fear, I believe. And it was still very hard for Bill, as basically, you know, he said goodbye to his spouse and to his children, to his grandchildren, to his friends. But for this couple, what they were saying was, yeah, that exists, but you know what? We're not going to focus on that. We know what's coming. We're going to focus on what we're grateful for what has given us. God has given us life and all these blessings. And we know that one day we're going to be with him, and that the worst thing is not the last thing. And so somehow, it's going to be okay. And Bill also said, you know, one way in which I'm coping with all of this is just by simply serving others, which is, you know, a testament to their lives anyway. It's what they did. He said, but as long as I have breath, I'm going to serve other people, and in that way serve God. And then he quoted the second general rule of the people who are called Methodists. All right, Methodists said. He said, you know, my job is to do all the good I can to everyone I can, as much as I can, as long as I can. That's how I want to live my life to the very end. And that is how he did. And that is how he did. And even when he was okay, and even when he wasn't okay, it was okay. Because he had no other God before him. I'm going to ask you again, what's the center of your life? What drives you? What do you focus on? What's most important? What do you trust in? Who is the source and sustainer of your life? And if it's anything other than God, I want you simply to invite you to pray today. Lord, forgive me. Forgive me for all the things that I have put in front of you. Help me to have no other gods before you. Would you pray with me? Oh God, you know what we wrestle with. You know what each and every one of us wrestle with. You know what I wrestle with. You know that all the times when we have allowed other things to take precedence over you. And so as we come before you today, We just pray to you, and I invite you just to very simply underneath your there, wherever you might be this day, to simply pray, ask God for God's forgiveness, and to give God thanks. Lord, thank you for forgive me for placing these other things before you. Lord, I give you thanks, and forgive me for placing these other things before you. And oh God, we give you thanks for the sun and the moon and the stars, for the air that we breathe and the life that we have, for forming us in our mother's womb, for promising us that at the very end you are there waiting for us, for sustaining us and carrying us, for never forsaking us. We give you thanks, oh God, for your love, for your mercy, for your grace. But you also know, Lord, how easy it is for self to be at the center of our lives. How easy it is for things like pleasure or power or wealth to be at the center of our lives. How hard it is for us to remember that none of those things are as good as you, O Lord. They are not meant to be on the throne of our lives, the center of our lives, O Lord. And so forgive us. Forgive us. May we long for you, not just to be in our lives, to be first in our lives. And so help us to love you with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, to seek you first. Lord, you are mine, and I am yours. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.